Well, thank you very much, Daryl. It's pretty hard to be the last. Especially when you had such very substantive speakers ahead of me, so I will do my best. It's also hard, having been a teacher, to teach in the middle of the afternoon. But I will do my best, but if you need to take a little rest, I understand. As Daryl said, I was the executive director of the Theological Consortium, which sponsors the Science and Religion Group. And I was happy to have helped start that group with the faculty members, some of whom are still very active a decade later. Currently, I'm the executive director of the Secretariat for Ecumenism and Interreligious Affairs of the Catholic Bishops. This is the first time in my life, but I'm required to say this is crossing the vineyard you're getting, and the Catholic Bishops have nothing to do with it. Also, I'd like to say the same about the consortium. I also want to thank people who commented on this talk and gave me good suggestions, many of which I've been able to follow up on, but also things that I will follow up on in the future. So thank you especially to members of the Science and Religion Group of the Consortium and others that I asked for their input and support. The relationships of science and religion has not been a topic of central concern to Catholic moral theologians in the past several decades. Moral theologians have focused on the renewal of moral theology called for at the Second Vatican Council and the related issues of moral methodology. And there was a huge debate for several decades about moral methodology that has now waned a bit, but that was the preoccupation. The findings of science have actually come into the practical discussions of particular moral issues, as we saw arise at the end of the Q&A for Father Wiseman's talk, especially medical moral issues. But the focus of various Catholic moral theologians has been elsewhere. The purpose of this short paper was to review some of the literature and to offer a few suggestions for further reflection. I decided to discuss three major authors in particular. I began with some reference to Joseph Pieper, distinguished philosopher, interpreter of St. Thomas Aquinas, dynamic philosopher, and reflects also on theology. I'm going to continue with the discussion of the detailed and important work of Stephen Pope. It's kind of the book to read in our field, Human Evolution and Christian Ethics. By the way, the version of this paper with the footnotes will be available online, and you can pursue some of these resources if you want. So I'm going to talk about Pope's book. He offers a thorough and a critical study. I then examine briefly the book that just came out from Redden and Purcell, From Big Bang to Big Mystery, another substantive work. He offers a wide-ranging synthesis of science and religion. We'll say a little bit more about Purcell's book, and the American version of which just came out like 2 months ago, and the European version came out last year. I should note that in the beginning, I followed the interpretation of Thomas Aquinas by Joseph Pieper on the understanding of reason and of truth. Aquinas defines prudence, the virtue of prudence, as reason perfected in the cognition of truth. You'll see that on the handout sheets. In discussing this definition, Pieper explains reason means for St. Thomas nothing other than regard for and openness to reality and acceptance of reality, of both natural and supernatural reality. Reason, or ratio in Latin, perfected in the cognition of truth, is therefore the receptivity of the human spirit to which the revelation of reality, both natural and supernatural, has given substance, says Pieper. There's a certain openness to the reality of things. So the prudence, this definition, it's not defined as it is in today's world, as getting my way, We're a type of cunning that makes for business success, but rather it's a reasonable openness to the reality of things as they are. The reasonable person knows reality, to further develop this, as it is capable of being known. Thus, some aspects of reality can be known scientifically, and others through different means, the literary analysis and appreciation of a poem, for example, is a bit different. The prudent or wise person is open to the truth of reality wherever that may lead. Thus, the modern theologian will eventually need to incorporate the truth of science into his or her thinking about morality. This will only be accomplished, I will add, after a review of the data of science as accepted in the field and as critiqued by other scientists. It's not an uncritical acceptance. As we saw in some previous decades, especially just in the Second Vatican Council, of certain psychological data and critically accepted, we need, and you see in these works, a critical analysis of the data. Also, in the beginning, I said that I'm a Catholic and would seek to integrate the scientific data into the best of Catholic moral thinking. My frame of reference is Catholic belief. At best, we who practice Catholic theology seek to accept the truth of things. This then may occasionally cause us to revise our ways of thinking about the human person and his or her moral formation or about moral issues. But we are open to the best in it. In a document that came out, if I can get this up, document that came out on March 15th this year, International Theological Commission meets twice a year, but as international scholars meet at the Vatican. They say this in number 46, moreover, occasions for interdisciplinary encounter and exchange between theologians and philosophers, natural and social scientists, historians, and so on should be fostered, since as it is indicated in this report, theology as a science thrives in interaction with other sciences, as they do also in fruitful exchange with theology. So even as recently as a month ago, document being posted at the highest level of theological thought or by top theologians, saying this dialogue needs to occur. And not just with scientists, but with people who are experts in other fields. The contender Joseph Pieper learned from Romano Guardini, the famous spiritual theologian of mostly the pre-Vatican II period, that the great German poet Goethe and Aquinas both taught that reality, which is by its very nature true, is the measure of human thought and action. The good moral, human moral action is rooted then in the silent contemplation of the truth of things, including, I would say, scientific truth, that makes for prudent judgment of what to do and not to do. Ilya Delio, who frequently attends these sessions, is now at Georgetown, said this in a recent publication from the Woodstock Center: there is a widespread sense today that science and religion have nothing in common, or should have nothing in common, since they are entirely different disciplines. We're arguing this conference, this series of conferences, for integration. We are arguing that just as theology benefited from the integration of Aristotelian philosophy by Aquinas and others, we too are called to integrate the truth of modern science into our thinking. Truth is one. Furthermore, science, as we know, this is just repeating actually a lot of what we have said or assumed today, science is not a self-explanatory system. There is need for further reflection that addresses deeper questions of human meaning. Going even further, we might say with Pieper that the real cannot be enclosed in any system of thought whatsoever, because it continually opens up towards something more that goes beyond it, arriving again and again at the frontier of the mysterious. Thus, while we can know a great deal, there are limits to our knowing. With this point, we touch on the roots of Catholic morality in the spiritual life. The relationship of spirituality to morality is a topic of great interest in moral theology today. Let me make a couple of citations in the footnotes of where some recent work can be found. In particular, I would say with St. Francis de Sales, patron of my religious community, and with many other Catholic spiritual thinkers, that the spiritual life is leading the life of virtue. Joseph Heber preceded the current revival of virtue ethics by several decades. He was writing in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and into the 60s. Yet he shares, Joseph Heber, some of the same concerns. He desired to move away from the Kantian ethics of duty, from utilitarianism, and from the excessive casuistry of Catholic neo-scholastic thought prior to the Second Vatican Council. It's very interesting to read the pre-Vatican II moral theology textbooks. They're quite different than the textbooks that are written today. They're very analytical, rational, logical, based on cases, somewhat floating in the sky a little bit. And people like Pieper, well before Vatican II, were saying, well, there's got to be more to it than just the analysis of moral cases in a very abstract way. We need to return to consideration of who the human person is who is making the moral decision. So Pieper wanted to offer an updated virtue ethics, which focused on the good of the human person. For him, the person is not self-sufficient, autonomous, as the Kantians say, or free of natural inclinations to the good. Thus, Pieper anticipated the current revival of virtue ethics and is concerned with the formation of the character of the Christian oriented to the future, as we see in numerous contemporary works of moral theology. Some of you might be familiar with the work of Stanley Hauerwas, the famous Methodist, or perhaps now Episcopal, theologian, who was one of the catalysts for the revival of virtue ethics after Vatican II era from a Protestant point of view. Because this revival, it cuts across, and I say in an article, one of those articles there, we refer to the virtue as an ecumenical ethic. There is substantially Catholic, as we see in Augustine Aquinas, Francis de Sales, up to the present moment in Pieper, and in just this tidal wave of books that are coming out on the virtues. Having said this, this is the intro, part one. I move into human evolution and Christian ethics. So Pope wrote the important book. It's considered the book to read. And I thought, well, maybe this book is a very detailed book, highly analytical. I noted in his introduction, he did like four Templeton summer seminars, I presume, working his way through the literature and the various topics. We can't even dwell on most of that. But we'll touch on some of it. It gives a detailed exploration of evolution and ethics. He says that scientists, as was mentioned this morning, have nothing to learn from theologians in their scientific work per se, says Pope in his book. But he said, however, Christian ethicists can play a valuable role in disentangling evolutionary science from its ideological misuses, pointing out the shortcomings of distorted applications of evolutionary theory to various kinds of human behavior, and showing that the moral and religious implications of evolutionary accounts of humanity can be interpreted non-reductionistically. The findings of science and religion can be mutually enlightening. In particular, Pope deals with the dispute between the Christian contention that the world is intrinsically morally meaningful, and the contention of evolutionary ontological naturalism, mentioned this morning, that the world only has the meaning we give it. So there's a philosophical distinction going here. Significantly, Pope argues that our knowledge of nature, including evolution, cannot determine the content of theological or moral affirmations. And to get ahead of myself, I support that. Actually, the specifics of Catholic morality need to be open to learning from science, evolutionary science, or other branches of science. But that's not necessarily determinative, the point we will be coming back to. Focus of the paper, then, is on the third part of Pope's well-researched book, which focuses on evolution and natural law. In particular, I will stress its importance for the consideration of the virtues. We should note here that classic Catholic moral theology, such as that of St. Thomas Aquinas, links natural law and the virtues. And I mention that because, as some of you are from Protestant backgrounds, that's not inherently obvious. It's not just natural law thinking as it is for some, and then virtue thinking by itself as it is for others. For us, it tends to be joined, as it was in Aquinas. But in some of the contemporary literature, you'll see them as separated out. I find Pope's work thorough, informative, though I disagree with some of his conclusions, but I think that his is the best, and very analytical, very fair, always critiques, tries to present fairly and then say what he thinks is right and wrong with any given position. I should note that he embraces the idea of emergence, which has been implicit in our discussions, that in evolution, there is an emergence going on to higher levels. He says this, a non-reductionistic reading of evolution that recognizes its inherent directionality is consonant with Christian belief in creation and in providence. He has a whole chapter on causality, secondary causality, things we've touched on. Human race is the product of a process that has generated unprecedented forms of emergent complexity. Christian theologians have long maintained that God operates through the secondary causes made available by the evolutionary process. The account of human nature as constituted by emergent complexity helps us understand aspects of key notions of Christian ethics, he argues, particularly human freedom, love of neighbor, human dignity, morality, and natural law. Pope begins his chapter on the natural roots of morality by discussing three ways evolutionists account for social morality. They see it either as adaptive, or as an evolutionary byproduct, or as a product of culture rather than biological evolution. He believes these explanations are inadequate, but he explains them all, critiques them all, and then goes on to make his own point. So, for example, discussing social morality as an evolutionary byproduct, Pope cites the scientist Francisco Ayala, who in discussing the biological roots of morality holds that three evolved capacities provide the basis of morality. The first is the ability to anticipate the consequences of one's action. The second is the ability to make value judgments. And the third is the ability to choose between alternative courses of action. So we have these capacities to do these things. The capacity for morality then is rooted in our biological constitution. The evolutionary process provides an emotional and cognitive constitution characterized by general proclivities, desires, or preferences, not a fixed moral code. These emergent capacities enable the person to make moral decisions. These decisions are not determined by biological or genetic factors. They're not determined by it. However, this is not to say that evolution has not shaped our rational and emotional capacities. In this regard, I say that in the consortium science and religion group way back when we had the visitor from NIH who wrote the book about the God gene, which we had a very interesting discussion. I'm not sure that anything else ever came of the God gene. But here we say, well, the genes in themselves are not determinative. Not to say they don't have an impact. And that's the distinction made by Pope here and made by other people in literature. Evolution has shaped our rational and emotional capacities. These human capacities must be taken into consideration when we shape our moral judgment. This fits in well, of course, with the teaching of Aristotle, Aquinas, and so forth. Natural abilities, powers or capacities can gradually shape by training, instruction, and habituation to become the adult's second nature. That is, the virtues or vices that constitute character. We are capable, says Pope, of experiencing a variety of basic emotions, but they can be subject to human evaluation and human direction. Our moral responses to these predispositions can include introspection, criticism, deliberate redirection, or revision of the place they have in our lives. We come to moral maturity. It's a kind of classic moral teaching. You look at your emotional life and what's enduring and what's helping, and ideally that your emotions go along with good moral decision making. If you're a person of good Christian character, it's not just a thought, but it's a feeling. It's a whole person, as we've been emphasizing here. The human person, while sometimes bowing to fitness interests, is also capable of adhering to the highest moral ideals, such as Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, which calls us to love, and love even of enemies. It's not just the clan or the people that have the same genes as us. It's much broader than that in Jesus' teaching, of course. The saints bear witness with their lives to this possibility of loving. The tradition of the church, however, points to how difficult living the life of love can be. The pull of selfish interest or interest solely in our group or clan can be strong. Thus, we have the practices of Lent, season we just finished, prayer, fasting, and almsgiving, to discipline some of our evolutionary desires and concern ourselves with the good of others beyond our immediate clan or kin. It's important to underline here that our contention is not, as it seems to be often, that we believe basically either in God or in evolution. It's rather that the God of Christian ethics, says Pope, continually sustains the world in being and orders it through the processes and patterns of nature. So it's not either or, it's your typical Catholic both and approach. Catholic faith and good science. As we said in the first section, it goes together in our thinking, it's not separate. I was listening to a tape the other day, or a CD the other day, of a history of science, and the author is Johns Hopkins, and the speaker, professor, he said, you know, Catholic schools are the only place where they're really teaching evolution these days. Because it's become so controversial that the textbook publishers, not wanting to lose sales, have reduced the size of the piece on evolution to pretty small so they could sell more copies. And so if you want to get the real thing, go to Catholic school. Of all places, right? But I learned evolution in high school in the early 60s. In Catholic high school in Philadelphia. Because we have to maintain who we are, that you go with the truth of things as best we can determine it. So it's evolution is truth, and you teach it. Or if it's nuanced truth, it's not true as some of these extremists say, what's the explanation of everything, but rather it has a truth, and we have to acknowledge what the truth is. Christians go further and contend that nature both is healed and transformed by grace. That's the work of the Holy Spirit in our hearts. Where the heart is, where the heart here, as it does classically, stands for the whole person. Now I will say a few words in the next section on original selfishness, which Dr. Domingue has a book about. So I just make some observations. Pope says a lot of the same. Fifth, he says in writing conclusion to one of the chapters, Christian ethics would seem willing to accept the socio-biological doctrine that people tend to be selfish both as individuals and as groups. This could be interpreted, he goes on to say, as one expression of the doctrine of original sin, that the Christian tradition distinguishes the condition of finitude and the premoral biological tendencies from the sinful selfishness generated by disordered choices and habits. There's an element of free will and choice here. Christian ethics has always been aware of the widespread tendency of individuals to prefer their own interests to those of others, to be biased toward members of their own groups and away from outsiders, to rationalize self-serving behavior through some type of supposedly moral stance. Christian ethics understands the roots of immorality in religious rather than natural terms. Here we see the importance of the reflection of our friend and colleague, Dr. Domi, who spoke this morning about the integration. In his paper, he has integrated his position relative to the work of Dr. Yulanowicz. He believes that Dr. Yulanowicz is right, that competition derives from mutuality, or from mutuality at a lower level. And this has been part of the classic thing, and I think Pope would modify his book a little bit because he stresses kind of the conflictual piece of evolution, and now we're saying that there is the chicken and the egg is the latest thinking, which you're hearing, of course, right here, the latest thinking, and this is it. These are two, they'll fit together. Pope has a whole chapter on altruism and the data pro and con, and he thinks it's part of the evolutionary process, but I don't think quite as prominent as you all have now made it based on the biological data. And I want to underline that, because there is advance in the scientific understanding. And part of the question of the Church of Moral Theology is the fact that the understanding of the scientists changes. And so one is pretty sure that this is correct. One does not make a major change in Catholic thinking on moral issues that may affect millions of people. So one has to be, of course, responsible and careful. I'm going to talk a little bit about natural law. Pope considers and offers his critique. In the beginning of his book, he critiques Catholic moralists who don't recognize the scientific data. Now, saying a word on their behalf, however, it's hard to be an expert in everything. The people he critiques, who are very prominent in our field, are experts mostly in philosophy. But to be expert in two fields is usually considered to be enough. And so you integrate the two. But to be expert in science takes a lot of doing. And so to integrate in science, we need more specialists like Pope, who has taken a long period of time to study and now are integrating as best they can. So what Pope does in his book, there are four major Catholic theologians who do integrate the findings of science into their moral theologizing, and he summarizes their commonalities this way. He says there are disputed points between them. The points of agreement are more important for the purposes of this book. They are generally critical of evolutionary ideology and reductionism, insistent on our recognition of the embodied and material nature of humanity, alert to the interdependence of culture and biology, and aware of the fact that human rationality is always tradition constituted. They all accept some teleological view of human nature, that there's a goal. The fact that we are naturally inclined to various kinds of goods, including biological goods, and understanding these natural inclinations as slowly tutored by communal practices that teach norms, ideals, and good habits. He goes on to reflect then on the natural law tradition. Natural law in Catholic thinking is not limited to basic biological inclinations, but includes distinctively human capacities. Natural law thinkers concern themselves with a comprehensive view of what is good for humans. Moral standards based on basic human inclinations promote human flourishing. So the virtues are to promote the flourishing of the human person. If you live a virtuous life, that's to be the good guy, to pursue those things that are good for human beings. Norms are not arbitrary or merely personal preferences. They reflect judgments about practices that promote flourishing. We see moral norms is not central to virtue, but there are moral norms. They promote human flourishing. So the moral life is the life of virtue. The virtues shape and perfect our capacities for knowing and for loving. Thus we go back to my favorite virtue these days, prudence, or practical wisdom, which I began with in the very beginning with Pieper. The virtue of prudence allows the moral agent to perceive the morally salient factors at stake in concrete human experience. The moral agent, as Pieper notes, needs to be clear-sighted in order to make good moral judgment. Where I agree with Pope, well, I agree with Pope in most of his work, like over 90%, I differ with him in his analysis of the conflict in pursuing moral goods. He notes that the moral tradition has tended to downplay the conflict between the goods that humans prefer. He says, for example, a conflict between the need for security and the need for food. There are these conflicts, he said, built into us by evolution, that we're pursuing different things, and these come in conflict with each other, and then how do we handle that? We have to deal with this. He said, it's still the case that human beings have been set up by evolution to experience multiple inclinations that sometimes reinforce, other times conflict with one another. And it is the case that communities are the scene of competition and conflict among and between both individuals and groups. So he goes on and takes the position, very controversial in our field, of whether one can not pursue or contradict one moral good and then pursue the other. And this is, I think, maybe this would not have been where to go. I'm quite hesitant to countenance this the direct negation of absolute moral goods. I note that Pope does not give this important matter extensive consideration in his penultimate chapter, but merely mentions his position. He says he thinks that at times we can violate one moral good to pursue another, but he doesn't really get into it. And I wonder about that. I part with him in his embrace of this revisionist position and some number of issues that he mentions towards the end of the book. His discussion is, as he says, not exhaustive. His position depends on a definition of natural law, which some Catholic natural law thinkers might dispute. In fact, there are a number of natural law theories in the river of Catholicism, and there are more emerging among the Protestants. This is the revival of natural law thinking starting to go on in Protestant circles. And so there's like, there are different definitions. And what do you mean by natural law? So he gives a certain definition, then predicates some of his positions on that. The problem of conflict of moral goods, it seems to me, is an important one that he raises. He cites the need for security versus the need for food that individuals experience. Such conflicts between goods need significant reflection. My own preference is to rely on the virtue of prudence. I have discussed this virtue at some length in a couple articles. I should note in this context, the Catholic tradition developed over the centuries what I like to call principles for practical cases, which help to guide prudential decision-making in tough situations where there is a conflict of goods. The principle of double effect, the distinction of ordinary and extraordinary means, and so forth in the moral literature help us form the prudential judgment. So you can see, let me tell you where I'm going. Actually, I'm resonating with what Dr. Yolanda had said part of his talk here. I think there are moral absolutes about doing the good and about avoiding the evil. I think that's important. I think there's a fair area in the middle for prudential judgment, the gray area. I think that some people would say, well, there are no moral absolutes. Relatively, absolutely not. Extensively, absolute. And everything's prudence. On the other hand, you can read some Catholic authors say there's very little room for prudential decision-making because it's all decided by the law. I don't agree with that either. I don't think that is consonant, certainly, with St. Thomas and the mainstream of the tradition. So what I'm trying to do is kind of walk a path here. I believe it's important that moral absolutes be honored. I reflect on the situation in South America, where eventually the World Council of Churches helped with pushing aside dictators who were murdering people in South America. Why? Because they thought the value of life was absolute. We had a human right to life. Therefore, they were acting in a subterranean way to overthrow dictators, or at least aid those who were working against the dictators. I'm a little afraid that if moral absolutes were banished, there would also be less reason to be actively opposed to people that are harming other people. So I think there are some moral absolutes. And of course, this is one of the debate areas of our field. I do want to talk about the human person, and I do want to talk about Brendan Purcell. He's a priest and a philosopher from Ireland, I believe. His big book is From Big Bang to Big Mystery, Human Origins in the Light of Creation and Evolution. He offers a profound synthesis of science, philosophy, and faith, and he makes a case for our massive belongingness to, along with a massive difference from, the rest of the material universe. He seeks to show that humans are both continuous with and different, discontinuous from material evolution. So we're both at the same time. So it's a work of philosophical anthropology. And his work differs from the discussion of it that we have seen from Pope. Because he draws on different authors, paleontologists, paleoanthropologists, other experts. He cites some literature. He gives example of real people and so forth, the famous people who he has known or knows of. He devotes five chapters to filling out empirically just what makes a human being human and why. But he focuses, and this is the point actually of discussing him, because his book is an easier read, I think, than the Pope book. They're very, very good, fairly comprehensive, a little bit of a different angle on this important topic, both very up to date. And if you were going to read something, I'd read one of these. If you're interested in lots of data on evolution, read Pope. If you're interested in a broad, more cultural, attuned approach, read Purcell. But I think they're the two best ones. But he talks about the seven characteristic grace notes, he calls them, of the human person. The first trio, and these are listed on that handout, the first trio of grace notes are amazing components of our humanness. Firstly, are specifically human genetic origins. He refers to this as genetic African Eve and Adam. We came from Africans, at least as Purcell analyzes all this data. It's out of Africa hypothesis is what he follows. Secondly, the cultural time sequencing of our growth. He goes through an extended discussion of how we're made and how the culture impacts that. And what are the good moments for learning, like how to speak, and how this all fits together with the brain, the physical body, and the culture, the education, and so forth, impinging on the child or the young adult. So he says our culture-oriented body plan. And thirdly, in what often has been described as the most complicated piece of matter in the entire universe, he says our brain and vocal tract. He goes through these discussions, too, of the pain involving all these scholars and how that speaks to us as well. And this is found in the next grace of being human. Symbolization and language. Because language, he said we think of bodies because language is a form of symbolization. He said these are not found in any of the pre-human hominids. They're distinctive. And finally, these last grace notes have been regarded as the most human of characteristics, understanding and freedom. These notes distinguish humans from other living things. Each of these notes is discussed at great length, much reference to the professional literature, as I've already said, but also with references to theology, major literary works, and to the example of some outstanding people. He discusses a Jewish person who was in a concentration camp, for example. Why would someone sacrifice way beyond the kin? Why would the martyr be killed? So this is, you know, the best. And thus you see some separation between the purely material and the human. He also discusses the worst. Albert Speer, Inside the Third Reich, The Justification of Evil. So it's very thorough, both these thoughts, as well as people, very thorough thinker. It was well worth an investment of time. So this work is in many ways a work about the culture that Pope speaks of, but in more detail. His extensive discussion of the Grace Notes gives us great insight in the culture that makes for human development. And then he has a couple chapters at the end about beauty and goodness, about the best of being human, and about human communion with one another, because we're made for community, going back to our talk this morning about the Trinity. So it's an integrated approach by a philosopher who's a priest. He doesn't get into specific moral issues, as we do a little bit in Pope, but he gives a general overview. Purcell's thinking is, of course, I said, relational. We are most human when we are in communion, in relationship with one another and with God. To do this, we must empty ourselves and immerse ourselves in the other's society and culture. He cites Martin Buber, the famous Jewish philosopher, to the effect that we must make the soul of others our own. So that's breaking out beyond the kin, making the soul of others our own. So he's pushing this, and it's a virtual approach. Finally, what do I conclude from all this? Well, actually, quite modestly. So I quoted Joseph Pieper. I'm going to conclude with a few reflections based on his thinking. Virtue, he says, in a quite general sense, raises the level of existence of the human person. Virtue is, as Thomas Aquinas says, the ultimum potentiae. It's the ultimate of what a human person can be. It is the fulfillment of our ability to be in the natural, our ability to be in the natural and supernatural sphere. The virtuous person is in such a way that from the innermost tendency of his being, he realizes the good through his actions. Of course, people were speaking long ago before the change in language that we've had. The central virtue for moral judgment then is prudence. The first of the cardinal virtues is not only the quintessence of ethical maturity, says people, but in so being is the quintessence of moral freedom. The prudent person, the truly prudent person, is morally free. Prudence is the virtue of mature moral judgment. A prudent person can make wise judgments in particular situations. Catholics believe that our moral judgments can't be guided by moral absolutes. Certain heinous acts can never be perfected of the person. They can never be acts of virtue. Certain good acts, acts of love, can be perfective of the person and of the community. There are many daily situations that do not involve moral absolutes to call for good prudential judgments about how best to live with and for other people. So now across a conclusion, I don't believe that a convincing argument has yet been made on evolutionary grounds for changing Catholic teaching on moral absolutes. So I think the debate in Catholic circles that some of you might be familiar with and the different schools of thought, that's going to continue because I don't see any data yet so far that's going to resolve that coming out of evolutionary theory, or at least out of these two major authors. I do believe that a convincing case has been made by Pope by Purcell, the Catholic moral theology would benefit from paying more attention to the findings of contemporary science. I think it ought to become more required and not just, you know, something that some do and some don't. And that will depend, I think, on whether we get enough people that write extensively in the field that those writers of textbooks and so forth would have things to draw on. I think that's part of what these authors have tried to do. Contemporary theology needs to seek the truth wherever it may be found. This search confronts us with the fact, emphasizing the biblical teaching, but not emphasized as much in the recent neo-scholastic period before Vatican II, that we are bodily creatures with certain inclinations. Christians must be formed by practices that enhance our inclinations to do the good for others, our altruistic tendencies, and limit our selfish inclinations. The virtues, our habits of doing good, help to integrate all aspects of the human person. It is the total person who acts. The virtuous person, using his or her emergent abilities to understand and to love, both knows and loves the good. Thus, a few reflections for your consideration.
But I do not understand, maybe that's naive, what you mean by natural law. Can you explain what you mean by natural law? I read or hear a lot about it, but I never quite understand what is meant by it.
Okay, so first of all, I'm saying there's different definitions and different schools of Catholic thought. I cite one because partially because it's my professor at Catholic U wrote the book and what an introduction to moral theology. And in his school of thought, it's coming to natural law, to what natural law is a rational reflection. My professor was originally a philosopher, became a theologian. A rational reflection on human inclinations and what the good things are that fulfill them. Very evolutionary, but of course the inclination to beauty and the good and so on and so forth. And then the thinking through of what does that mean for us and how we should and should not act. Now, he's not a virtue ethicist. Documented, it became more of a deontologist. You know, the law, then there's the principles or laws that you should follow in doing the good. Okay, I part from that. Because I am, as you see in this paper, I think the virtue of prudence, which allows better for the gray areas that not everything is pleasant. Well, some things aren't. And therefore, I would emphasize that more than that. But I never told Dr. May that I digressed from what I learned at his feet. But that's one definition, and it's clear. I mean, some mix theology and philosophy more. But the main position, which is Dr. Grisey's and Dr. Finnis's position, the new epistemological atomism, is much more rational. And it's the reasonable reflection on, and we, their school thinks that we get to these conclusions.
I find the definition totally acceptable.
Okay.
Thanks. The problem is that often it's confused with technology.
And
so technology is a bad thing, you see. This is where the problem really is.
Yes, but this is not their problem. Yeah. I should note in the Vatican 2009 document from the International Theological Commission on Natural Law, they do begin the first section. And so looking for an international morality, since the Vatican has been advocating for like international judiciary and an international economic system with some decision makers, they reflect on the other religions at the beginning of their essay of the International Theological Commission. What do they hold and what therefore do the religions have in common? So it's not just for them a pure reflection on human inclination, but it cuts across cultures and religious communities. So they take a bit different tact than Dr. May and his colleague among the so-called Kantian thomists.
I wanted to make a comment about your comment about Martin Buber saying, making the soul of others our own. I think one way of fleshing that out is that in some of Buber's writing in A True I Thou Authentic Relation, somewhere along the line he speaks of the reality of the between. When the two are in a true I Thou dialogue, there is this sense of the between, this sense of oneness.
Right.
So that strikes me as a wonderful way of seeing how the soul of others can be our own.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. But we could explore Martin Buber. It's explored more in the book, but just to read Buber in himself is a good thing. And especially fits in with these kind of models for relationality. I contend in one of my books that the virtues are developed in relationships, that we imitate other people, that we learn from other people. We're not by ourselves, just by willpower, developing the virtues, but we develop them in the community, a relationship to others. I couldn't get into that, but it relates to the point about Buber.
Is it possible to differentiate between our state of ethical maturity with the negative effects of original sin?
Well, I think, yes, we do distinguish more in the case of spiritual maturity. It's more in the literature of stages of spiritual growth. Now, we would say that there's always some, in this life, there's always some effect of sin. But what we notice is people who are becoming more spiritually mature, the effect, they struggle with not doing the good. And that's not just because I read in books, it's because I talk to a lot of people about the spiritual journey. And people say, well, you know, Father, I can't do the sins I used to do. I don't want to do them. But I'm trying to do the good, and, you know, I'm not always doing so good, doing the good. And that's like a phase. It's, you know, there's the phase of repentance, returning to Christ, the stage of kind of getting the right balance in your life of what's really important, what's less important. But then we see further in the spiritual writers who say you oscillate back and forth. You're never totally at one stage. But where the task is more and the call is more to turn everything to the good. Where we see less the effects, as we would say, classically of original sin, and more the effects of divine grace in the life of prayer. So that's how I would break it up. So I think it's the spiritual roots of moral theology. Okay, the virtues are developed in the spiritual life. And yes, you have to do your homework of learning about evolution and all sorts of other things to make good moral decisions. And I do think it might bear, I think this is about the wise men, as to whether there are further, if there's stages of evolution, and Purcell, in the piece of this paper I skipped, he says, you're doing Catholic thinking, you gotta start at the Big Bang and work forward. You gotta consider, but then can't we go forward after death? Could we say there's stages like purgatory? People laugh when I say, I'm just hoping to get to purgatory. Catholic thinking, you know, there's a stage. It's not just, as some Protestant friends say, just heaven or hell. We say, well, there's something in between. But could you say there's stages of union with God? And could you say there's an initial stage and then a stage at the second coming of Christ or something like that? Well, it's all pretty theoretical because we don't know too much about that. But, you know, would it make sense based on everything else we said today? Well, I hope so. Well, thank you very much. Sure.